Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, horror movies that make you emotional. We asked 500,000 horror fans online what horror movies got them in the feels, and we're here with their answers and ours. Let's quickly define what we mean by emotional. Clearly, fear is an emotion, and we're not talking about that because this podcast episode would then be 13 years long. No, we mean that misty-eyed, ugly cry, trying to hold back those little sounds kind of emotion that is supposed to be the exclusive realm of dramas, rom-coms, and biopics, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Whale, La La Land, and The Imitation Game. And this is one of the reasons I love the horror genre. It can invade the other genres and do what they do. The horror genre can go Western. It can go funny. It can get you emotional. But those genres can rarely do that back. Unless you have like a pathological fear of bagels, Everything Everywhere All at Once isn't going to scare you. Unless you're wanted for desertion from the Confederate Army, Hateful Eight isn't going to terrify you. But the ending of King Kong can make you cry like you're watching an episode of This Is Us. And Bone Tomahawk can make you feel like you're watching Tombstone for like an hour. So what horror movies could 500,000 horror fans online agree upon as the most emotional? Well, an interesting thing happened in the voting, we noticed. Although we asked about movies, what most people talked about were scenes. And a few people threw in TV shows. Totally valid. We're going to include those. So we'll give you the top votes, but also talk about the scenes that got them there. And unlike a lot of times when we do votes like these, there was a very clear runaway winner in this voting, which I'm betting if you stopped and thought about it for a second, most emotional horror movie, you've probably already guessed. And after we count those down, we'll give you a couple of our top choices that didn't appear in the voting. And interestingly, before we get to the countdown, Insidious The Red Door, which we have not seen yet, got a decent amount of votes. Not nearly enough to crack like the top 15, but it was kind of amazing and cool to see it there. Now I'm way more excited to see that movie than I was before we did this vote. So at number 10 was Night of the Living Dead. In particular, the ending scene of the original Night of the Living Dead. As Lee said in the voting, Ben, played by Dwayne Jones, who gave a very compelling performance that just makes you feel your heart is ripped from your chest when he meets such an unjustified fate in this movie. Now, Night of the Living Dead has been more written about and talked about and discussed than almost any horror movie, so I have nothing fresh to add to this. Except for in terms of the emotional framing, one, I'm super glad to see George Romero make this list. He struck me as the kind of creator that had like the hard outward shell and the gooey interior, kind of. We had done a post on the Horror Weekly Facebook page recently about how Mr. Rogers, of all people, was a tremendous supporter of George Romero in his early times and, you know, endorsed the zombies in Dawn of the Dead. And it was just an amazing thing to see those two link up. But the fact that George Romero is here is really cool to me because I think as much as he tried to run away from any conventional kind of emotional moments in movies because he was so rebellious in his interior and motivations, that all still just came across. Like those deep feelings seeped through what he was doing almost despite what he wanted. And the other reason it's awesome is here is just the mastery of his craft, the way he built the character of Ben into someone we deeply cared about. A lot of it just with visuals, not even with dialogue, and some of it with just the circumstances this poor character was placed in and the choices that he made, which we all kind of hope are the choices we'd make in like an apocalypse scenario, but are unlikely to be the case. But the nobility of a lot of what that character was trying to do really came across without a lot of dialogue or a lot of exposition. And movies these days don't really do this that much. So to see an old school one rise to the top like this and still make into the top of the voting is just spectacular. And speaking of a master of the craft, at number 9 comes in David Cronenberg's 1986 remake masterpiece, The Fly. Now, clearly, it's the ending or the generation of this character that everyone was voting for. But I remember when I first saw this film, as a huge Cronenberg fan, just being really struck by how sad I was feeling even at the beginning of the movie. I mean, I was familiar with Vincent Price's original The Fly and the terrifying, help me, like, you know, moments of it. But you could tell that Jeff Goldblum's character was doomed from the start in this movie. And even worse, you could tell that Gina Davis was going to be emotionally sucked in and also just really put through it from the very first moments of this film. So it just felt like one of those tiny snowballs of sadness that you start at the top of a hill and roll down, and it's the size of a baseball, and then it turns into a boulder, and then it turns into an avalanche. Like, this movie was just an unstoppable course of sadness. And, you know, people tend to talk about Cronenberg when they talk about Cronenberg movies. But, and of course, this is partially due to his talent at casting. But Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis at the top of their games, or at least the top of their early career games, there's the reason why this movie made this high up in the list, even though there's incredibly sad moments across hundreds and hundreds of horror movies. It's just so memorable because the performances are so damn good. I'm a huge defender of Crimes of the Future, and I'm probably going to go back and do a full episode on it at some point, much to the dismay, I'm sure, of some of the people who would advise me not to. But here's the thing. The acting in Crimes of the Future, I don't even know like what the three notches above over the top is for what Kristen Stewart was doing in that movie. And then Viggo Mortensen at the end is just, that is a movie that got me emotional at the ending in the chair scene. So we'll get to that in a later episode. But there, it's undersold how good the acting in a lot of Cronenberg movies are. They get the special effects and the body horror and the philosophy behind it are like the scene stealers, but they don't work without amazing performances, which he got a lot. Our movie, or at least scene, that comes in at number 8 is weirdly appropriate at the time we're recording this, since as I'm speaking, like literally 10 minutes ago, I watched the newly dropped trailer for Ridley Scott's movie Napoleon. And the trailer and the poster kind of bang, but also really worry me. This is either going to be one of the best movies of the year or like Mystery Science Theater bad. I'm not sure which way it'll go, but Joaquin Phoenix is amazing and also possibly spectacularly miscast in that movie. But coming in at number 8 on our emotional horror movie countdown is Joaquin Phoenix in Signs. Now, honestly, watching this movie come in at number 8 in the voting was one of my favorite things that happened in the last little while on the Horror Weekly Facebook page. This is what makes running the page worth it, because the voting was kicked off by Cindy Long, who said, "Don't kick me out, but the dinner scene in Signs." And she got so much support, and there was so much upvoting of that comment, even though she clearly was scared that it was going to be mocked, or, you know, people hate Signs, or horror fans hate Signs, whatever. But Lisa Fernandez backed her up in the voting was like, I also love the end when you can hear the kids laughing in the background while Graham puts on his church clothes. And Natalie said, me too. I love that movie. And that scene was so well acted and really conveyed what I would imagine it feels like when you are scared and not sure what will happen next. All the nerves and emotions bubbling to the surface. Great scene. And I have to believe, given the food choices there, that this was authentic, because only Joaquin Phoenix would have picked what he picked during this meal when they're assembling the meal and Mel Gibson is like, I'll have a cheeseburger. And the kids are like, I'll have mashed potatoes and French toast. And it's all comfort food. And then they turn to Joaquin Phoenix and they're like, what are you going to have during this amazing meal? And he's like, chicken teriyaki. I mean, say what you want about M. Night, and there's a lot I don't like about what he's done. There's an amazing book called, well, I actually don't remember the name, but it's a behind-the-scenes making of history of the movie Lady in the Water, where he comes across not that great. But this scene, this dinner sign scene, I just can't imagine any other director pulling this off and having it even have the remotest chance of working. So I love that this was in the voting. Okay, at number 7, we have The Orphanage. And I'm kind of at a loss here because I haven't seen The Orphanage, I must confess. And I immediately will rectify that error after seeing all the amazing voting behind this. But Cody Lakin, who is an incredible horror author that you should check his writing out, he commented to kick off the voting, I remember I almost cried at the end of The Orphanage the first time I saw it. And then immediately under that, Kat Torres said, same, but I was a young mother to a toddler when I saw The Orphanage, so it hit me right in the gut. I can't wait to check The Orphanage out. At number 6 is Pet Sematary. And there were just dozens and dozens of comments of people who said, as parents, they could only watch or read or both this once and never go back. And you can totally see how that was. Matter of fact, one of the haunting comments in the voting was someone who just put that little gym shoe. And it's interesting when you think about, like, It's Alive or The Omen, how taboo this still is. And even though these are, like, iconic horror movie memories and moments, there are still so few movies willing to try this topic. But of all the movies that have been brave or foolish enough to attempt it, Pet Sematary rose to the top in our emotional horror movie rankings. And speaking of Stephen King, at number 5 is Brian De Palma's 1976 adaptation of Stephen King's Carrie. Now, I find it super interesting here that of the choices we've covered so far, really the only two sympathetic, emotional, evocative villains, quote unquote, on the list are Jeff Goldblum's character in The Fly and Carrie White in Carrie. I can't speak for what was happening in The Orphanage. Gage is certainly not the villain in Pet Sematary. He has no agency about getting turned into a villain at all. But I feel like if you scratch away the surface differences, Seth Brundle and Carrie White are actually pretty similar in their arcs, with the one crucial difference that Carrie was just born with a gift she didn't ask for. Seth made a choice of pushing the boundaries of experimentation too far. And that makes this fascinating to me because Seth has way less of a quote-unquote body count. He kills and injures far fewer people than Carrie does, but Carrie is way higher in the voting of emotional sympathy on the list. And I think the crucial thing here is that Carrie is embedded in a social context. She's bullied and can't get out of it. Seth is living a pretty loner life, pushing the edge of things, but totally of his own motivation and accord. And it's kind of haunting to me that Seth, just as awful as the ending of The Fly is, basically gets put out of his misery. But whatever that dream sequence-ish thing that's happening at the end of Carrie, whether you think that's real or not, it still is indicative of the mindset of the people in that town and the people who dealt with Carrie, that even her grave would be desecrated, would be graffitied. She's getting bullied even after she's passed. She can't quite escape even after she dies the awful dynamics of what made her life so terrible. So it's easily one of the most emotional, definitely is one of the ones on the list that made me feel emotional the first time I saw it and kind of every time I've seen it. All right, let's get off the Stephen King train and get onto the Hereditary, I'm not going to say car, let's go with the wagon. Daniel Parrish started off the voting with Hereditary for the scene where she's found with her beheaded daughter and cries, "I want to die, I want to die." That's real hard for a parent to watch. And that's interesting because that ties back to Pet Sematary earlier in the voting. When Diane cast her vote, she said, "Another vote for Toni Collette and Hereditary. Stumbling on the horror in her car, I don't even want to know what well Miss Collette drew from to go there. Her agony is so raw and palpable. I've watched that movie several times, and I still well up during that scene." So now that we've gotten this far along in the voting, a pattern has emerged. And it's parenting. It's parent-child, right? Whether it's Pet Sematary or The Orphanage or Hereditary, I mean, even Signs, that dinner scene, it's the hug of the father with his children that is the most evocative. Fully half of the top 10 votes so far have been parenting related. And that's super fascinating to me. It makes me want to go through a lot of my favorite horror movies, especially ones that I suspected might make me feel emotional, and see if there's some kind of parenting, parent relation, child element in them. But I find this really fitting because we're going to our number 3 vote, which includes the parents that piss me off more than any parents in horror movie history. And it's not their fault. It is absolutely not their fault. This is all on me. But coming in at number 3 on the emotional horror movie list is Monster Squad. Particularly the Phoebe, please don't go away, Frankenstein scene. Now first, let's just say, how dare this movie make wreck us this hard? This is absurd. I mean, Fred Dekker and Shane Black are lucky this is a movie, because if this was real, if this happened in life, it would be a crime against humanity. They would be tried. Part of the seasoning that makes this scene work is the actual awfulness of Dracula. Because Duncan Rager is lurking around in this kids' movie as one of the most awful Draculas ever to appear on screen, the harshness of his approach is like the sour to the sweet of this movie. So he gets staked in the heart and sucked away, and then all is good, right? And then all of a sudden, you realize other things are getting sucked into the vortex, like cars and like park furniture, and Frankenstein is holding on to Phoebe, and you gradually realize as a viewer that all the monsters, everything extraordinary is going to get sucked back out of reality, out of this world, right? Because we can't walk around believing in or having confirmation of our belief in ghosts and monsters or whatever. That would be a game changer in how we lived our lives. So everything has to reset to basic. And then that's when you know, that's when you get that pit in your stomach feeling that everything is going to get sucked away, including Frankenstein. And Phoebe and Frankenstein, they feel it too. They know it. And then Frankenstein gets pulled into the vortex, and the cruelest turn of the screw of all is when Phoebe throws her teddy bear to Frankenstein so he doesn't feel lonely wherever he's going. Jesus Christ. This is like the horror version of the Home Alone, like Kevin McAllister giving advice to the old guy scene. in the church where, like, the kids are wiser than we are. But then after Phoebe does an amazing line reading of the phrase, please don't go away, Frankenstein, like, I don't know, 500 times or whatever it is, Frankenstein disappears into the distance. And then Phoebe collapses in grief at the loss of her friend at the park bench, which, by the way, the park bench made it. What the hell? Like, Frankenstein gets sucked away? The park bench is, like, riveted into the ground? And then the parents rush over while she's sobbing, and they, like, gather her up, and they're like, she's fine. They, like, turn to each other, like, she's fine. Fuck you. And I get it, right? Like, their daughter survived whatever this the events that just occurred were. But, like, she's emotionally scarred. She has to be. We're emotionally scarred just looking at it. Most aggravating parents ever. And I think by focusing on emotionality in horror movies, it really made me hone in on the glory of Frankenstein's monster as a character. To filmmakers, this character must be like throwing darts at a dartboard that's a mile wide. I mean, you cannot miss. Whether it's the use of the creature in the amazing and ethereal The Spirit of the Beehive, or it's how Kenneth Branagh and De Niro use the creature, it's Frankenstein's monster was one of the first, if not the first, films ever made from Thomas Edison in like 1910. And if Mary Shelley is Frankenstein's mother, then James Whale is certainly Frankenstein's father. And we have that incredible biography of James Whale, Gods and Monsters, with Ian McKellen and Brendan Fraser. I mean, there's Frankenweenie, there's Frankenhooker. I think it's even Frankensteinian what's happening in Return of the Living Dead Part 3. And what's the thread that runs through all these movies? They all have a really high chance of hitting you emotionally. And this doesn't happen with a lot of horror's other characters. Like, when I followed Bruce's career through the Jaws movies, I was super emotional watching the original Jaws, but I can't remember feeling emotional in Jaws 2. The only emotion I felt during Jaws 3 was laughter. And Jaws 4, I mean, whatever bleak is as an emotion. So it makes so much sense to me that Monster Squad is here and so high on the list, especially when you add in a little girl who's going to dearly miss her friend. You have the rest of the kids in the movie and the other monsters. It's kind of like a Losers Club it situation. All of these things are surefire emotional elements. And now that we've reached second place on our list, we're going to keep going with the parent vibe, because this is Train to Busan, and there were so many comments in the voting about how if you don't shed a tear at the end of Train to Busan, you're a psychopath. And aside from the surface elements, a selfish man learning to be a better father, and a child in danger, and people who are bonding in the middle of this horrendous crisis, all of which are good ingredients for the recipe of making the viewer feel emotional. Something I think Train to Busan does really well is it makes the zombie bite itself a little more metaphorical. It always kind of is when you look at it sideways and squint, because the zombie bite, when it happens to characters that we love in whatever movies it happens to them in, it kind of represents a mistake. Like in Train to Busan, we have a man who lived pretty badly, and now he's turning it around to save his daughter, and he's learning that lesson. But he has done so much wrong in the past that it just figures that there was no way to just turn this around and get to a happy ending cost-free. And what's really touching here is zombies are inherently selfish. That's all they want. All they want to do is eat. And they have no thought to the damage they're going to inflict. They have no thoughts at all, except for maybe like logistically, tactically, how to get from point A to B and how to feed next. And this behavior is selfishness distilled. Well, the father in Train to Busan was selfish, and now he's been bitten, and he gets his daughter Set to head to safety, and then he's about to turn. He actually is turning the last we see him, and he throws himself off the train, which is doubly impactful for this character, because this character was always commuting. He was always trying to get somewhere. He was always on the hustle. He was always trying to, like, get for himself. And he's also become super hungry as a zombie. So what he wants to do is turn around and start eating. But what he actually does is lets himself fall off the train in a great silhouette shot. So really what it is a fantastic triumph over selfishness. And adding that extra layer of analogy to what the zombie bite represents is one of the things that I think makes the movie super touching and takes it from good to great. And now we're at our number one in the voting. And I bet it will not surprise you when I say that it's Frank Darabont's 2007 The Mist. And even though it's clearly the end scene that is making everyone vote for this movie, and like I said before, it won by quite a margin, this movie just wins by numbers because there are so many emotionally touching scenes in it besides just the ending. I mean, in terms of emotion, this movie is almost like a great jazz piece because it's just doing endless variations on all kinds of emotions that you feel when you watch characters go from in the span of things. I mean, from the really sad, one of the first things that pops into my head when I think about this movie is that moment right after the mist has first arrived and the woman's going to her out, trying to go out to her car to get home to her kid. And she's like turning to the people in the market saying, "Won't someone see a lady to her car?" And there's just no courage to be found in the group. They're all just reeling in shock from the first impact of what's happening. So that's the emotion you feel when you're watching people at the bottom level of courage. But then that amazing moment when Toby Jones' character finds his courage and takes out the awful Mrs. Carmody, one of the greatest villains ever in horror cinema, I'm convinced. Magnificently portrayed by Marcia Gay Harden. There's the group in the back of the market fighting the tentacles, and you have Thomas Jane showing enormous courage along with Toby Jones again, but you have the rest of the group that was mocking before just hanging back and being complete cowards. There's an interesting book by Friedrich Nietzsche called Beyond Good and Evil, and I like that dynamic when you get to that space. And when you get to the moment where the final group in the car at the end just kind of gives up, that moment is beyond courage and cowardice. They are just completely overwhelmed. But another element that makes this movie really work emotionally is how relatable it is. You can really feel like you're there with these people. I feel like after watching this movie, if any of the characters from the movie just walked into a room I was in, if that was like at a bar and they just came in and sat next to me, I know exactly how they would behave. I know kind of what they would say. You've really gotten to know these people. That relatability element might even be Stephen King's superpower. It's why it's not surprising there's, three entries of his on the top 10. If I got to look back, it might be more. And, of course, there's the gut punch ending, which is just, you know, I rewatched this recently and I forgot how long that stretches. You remember it as just like that moment, that flash when you see the vehicles come out of the mist. But it's stretched out. Like, there's people looking at him. He's got time to really go have that emotion build. Thomas Jane does as the character. It's really remarkable that it's like, it's really like the evilest Twilight Zone episode twist that's ever been imagined. So those were our top 10 emotional horror movies according to you. Thank you to everyone who voted. I want to toss in a couple honorable mentions real quick, just because the comments that came with the votes were so cool. The Exorcist got a decent amount of votes, not nearly enough to crack the top 10. But there was a great comment from Becky Phillips who said, "Watching The Exorcist after being a parent for years hits different. I have 4 grown kids and a grandson. The last time I watched it, I teared up when Chris is berating the doctors in the conference room and when she is on the bench with Karis begging him to help her. I could feel her frustration and fear for her child's life. And I think that's such a good and interesting point, because there are so many horror fans who complain that they've seen so many, they've gotten so jaded, nothing can scare them anymore. And that might be true, right? Like, you might have been really hit by horror movies when you were young and you're chasing that feeling, and it's hard to get that feeling back again, naturally. But these movies do change over time, and what we lose in the scare factor sometimes in a really, really well done movie like The Exorcist, like a masterpiece, these movies are not the same movies you see when you're young. As you get older and experience things, the movies themselves kind of change with you. Certainly seeing The Shining young as a preteen and then seeing it much later after you've lived some life and realized, like I have, that you struggle from some addiction problems, it's an entirely different movie. And Dr. Sleep is something that really picked up on that and understood that it's a movie that sank into the culture and was ahead of its time in a lot of ways. Now, for the other honorable mention, and this is my favorite thing that happened in all of the voting, Belinda McKay said, "The Final Girls, the 2015 summer camp slasher parody movie." And what she put was, "Even after losing my mom for more than 10 years, the scene between the mom and daughter where she tells her to let go makes me sob. My mom introduced me to my love of horror. I miss her so much." And that's just incredible. Comments like that are really why we do the page in the first place. So thank you, Belinda, for saying it. There were so many other people who kind of mentioned this movie. It was close. I wanted it to get in the top 10. It didn't have enough votes, but it was probably like 13th. There was someone named Dart who said, "The part where they play Betty Davis Eyes by Kim Carnes makes me cry every time." I might have mentioned this in a previous podcast episode, but we had someone comment on the page that they had owned a video store for years and they were really down about the loss in sales and they were thinking about shuttering it and just closing and walking away. And then they watched the movie Final Girls and fell in love with movies again, because that movie is so like cinema rich. It's so meta that they just got the inspiration to carry on from this one movie, this horror movie. And look, that movie is not perfect. It's not all that it could have been, for sure. But there is something really magical in that film that I cannot put my finger on that it makes it like, I mean, I suppose a lot of people considered it a miss, but I think this is going to be one of those movies people look back on. Sometimes the magic movie lightning just strikes. So my emotional horror movie, above all others, is Cat People from 1942, directed by Jacques Tourneur and produced by the incredible Val Lewton. It stars Simone Simon, Kent Smith, and Jane Randolph, among others. Cat People has a very, very underrated sequel called The Curse of the Cat People, which is a wonderful film. And then there's a really interesting remake directed by Paul Schrader in the early 80s, I think maybe 1982. So if you haven't seen Cat People, there's a character named Irina. She's a fashion designer who's living in New York, but she hails from Serbia. She starts up a romance with an engineer named Oliver that's played by Kent Smith. They get married, and then she discovers that she's basically like a were-leopard. The couple drifts apart, mainly because Oliver's an asshole, and then he starts confiding in it to his beautiful assistant, Alice, about his marital issues, and Irina gets madder and madder, and then she goes on a killing spree. Now, I've seen Cat People more than a dozen times, and it makes me feel emotional every time I've seen it. It cannot miss. It's pretty hard to explain the heart, so there's probably reasons this movie works at me that I don't even know, I'm not even aware of. But the things I've been able to dig up are, one is the amazing atmosphere of the film. Of all the horror movies I've ever seen, it's the one where I feel like I go into the screen the most. The atmosphere is just so rich and so detailed, and so it's really like fog drenched the way a Hammer film might be, like a Hammer Dracula film, but it's also really urban as well. So it's like got really clean, minimalistic lines and buildings and shapes. But the other thing is, I think Irina is the loneliest character in major horror film that I've ever seen. She's basically Carrie White, but she has the same arc. She's pulled in by something that is extraordinary that she has inside of her that is hard to control, but she's pulled in, you know, not by any choice of her own. Oliver basically pulls her into a relationship. She's just literally painting by herself, sketching at the zoo when he approaches her, and then sets this whole shit show into motion. She has no real friends. She's stalked by a mysterious person that's not really from her past. It's just someone from her country who shares the same curse. She's completely betrayed by her psychiatrist who just wants to sleep with her. But the moment that really gets me, and I can't think of other horror movies doing this very frequently. It'll probably all come back to me after I'm done recording this, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head. Let me know. Send me a message if there's anything that lines up with what I'm about to just say from another movie. But it's something that happens to the character that we're aware of, but the characters in the movie are not. So it's just the audience that knows, but it's super sad. So Irina kills the psychiatrist when she's in cat form. She gets possibly fatally wounded by a sword in that fight, and part of it broke off and is in her shoulder, which she's covering up with her coat. She sneaks out of the apartment because the noise has attracted the attention of the neighbors, so people all start converging on that spot. Plus, Oliver's arriving with his new wife-to-be that he just like immediately moved on past Irina. And he's heading up the stairs, and she hides behind a plant in a corner. And they go right by her without knowing she's there. Pretty fitting for a cat. And then she heads down the stairs, and she looks up, and she waves to him. He's going into the apartment, and it looks like he's about to turn and see her. And she waves to him, and he just carries into the apartment. And she just has this incredibly sad look on her face as she lets her hand drop, realizing that she's about to die and that nothing is going to work out and that he didn't even see her final goodbye. And she just slinks off to go to the zoo. And at the zoo, she opens a cage and lets one of her fellow big cats kill her, put her out of her misery. And then she's lying alone next to the empty cage. The cat runs away and gets killed. So all of this is horrifying. All of it is just horrifying. For a movie from 1942, this still packs such an emotional punch. But the craziest thing at the end here, and I don't even know if this is on purpose or just luck, but at the very beginning, when Oliver met her at the zoo and started hitting on her, she took one of her sketches of a cat and crumpled it up and threw it at a basket and missed. And he picked it up and put it in the basket and started teasing her for littering. That's literally how they met. And she drops another one, and it's just a piece of litter on the ground. It's like such a clean area. This zoo is kept immaculate. And there's this one piece of trash just laying on the ground forlorn. Well, at the very end of Cat People, Oliver arrives and finds her dead on the ground. Oliver and Alice see the sword, broken off sword, sticking at her. He turns to her and says the incredibly aggravatingly stupid line, "I guess she never lied to us." Like she actually was someone who turned into a cat. And then they just walk away. And the last shot is just seeing her crumpled up on the ground like a piece of trash, like the litter that started the whole movie. It's just such a haunting, haunting end to me, to a character who never had a chance, who was doomed all the way through. So Cat People is an extraordinary film that still works to this day. If you search the phrase Luton Bus, you'll see that This is the movie that was considered to have invented jump scares, which is incredible. I went to see this movie in a theater on a big screen restoration with a friend who had never seen it. And when the bus jump scare moment happened, he jumped in his seat. This is a movie that's almost 100 years old that still has bite. It's a dark magic spell of a film that shakes me every time. So that's it for this week's episode of Horror Weekly. I'm sure you can tell by my voice that I have something that I'm fighting. So it's been a little bit of a struggle. Hope I made it. Hope it doesn't sound too terrible. Guess it's strangely appropriate that it sound really husky in an episode about things that make you feel emotional, not on purpose. Thank you so much to everyone who put thoughtful, interesting, like opening themselves up comments in the voting. It was so appreciated. It's what makes these episodes interesting and gives us ideas for future episodes. If you're not following us on Facebook at Horror Weekly, that's where most of the conversation happens, although we're really growing on Threads. So if that's a place where you're willing to go, I know some people are not trying not to add another social media thing into their lives. Totally respect that. But because the nature of what we're trying to do here is conversational, and we have a great success on Facebook with it, but let's be honest, Facebook comments are not the easiest place to have long-form conversations. Threads is a place where you can have more detailed, longer conversations. That's what we're trying to do here. So it's the best place to do that. So if you can follow us there, it's Horror Weekly Pod. I'll put a link in the show notes. And thank you to everyone who responded to last week's request by dropping a review or rating on Spotify or Apple. It's amazing to see the numbers go. The goal was to get to a 4.8 rating out of 5.0. And there were enough ratings to do that, except for someone gave a 2-star rating. So it briefly went to 4.8 and then it ticked back down to 4.7. So if you haven't given a rating yet and you're willing to, particularly on Spotify, although everywhere is appreciated, we're so close. I saw it go to that 4.8 goal mark, and then I was going to talk about it on this episode, and then it went back down, which is fine. I mean, some people aren't going to enjoy this. That's totally fine. But we're really trying to get to that next marker. So if you can help get us there, that's a great way to support the podcast. And anyway, thank you so much for listening. Until next Wednesday, have a great horror week.